climate change the facts? The Scientists and the Apocalypse by Bernie Lewin. Part 1. Bernie Lewin is the author of the climate change blog, Enthusiasm, Skepticism, and Science.
The meeting of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, in Sundsvall, Sweden, August 1990, witnessed a third world revolt that was premeditated and forewarned. It had already begun in the previous working group meetings set to develop international policy responses to the climate crisis, but only in Sundsvall, under the leadership of Brazil, did it succeed in smashing this carefully conceived science-to-policy process at its very nexus. Within months, the revolution was complete. At the United Nations General Assembly that December, the climate treaty process was taken from the IPCC and its UN parent bodies, the Environment Programme, UNEP, and the World Meteorological Organization, WMO. Instead, a new negotiating committee would report directly to the General Assembly, where the poorer countries commanded an overwhelming majority. The IPCC, dominated by scientists from rich countries, was directed to serve this new committee in the interim, until a subsidiary body for technical advice could be established. As for the two peak science policy organizations who first conceived the IPCC, by winter 1991, they were out in the cold. This banishment from the treaty process was particularly shocking for UNEP. In the afterglow of its success with the Ozone Treaty, it was coming up to the 20th anniversary of its inception at the 1972 UN Stockholm Conference, where global environmentalism was born. Riding a new wave of environmental consciousness, another grand conference was in the planning to mark the anniversary. The Rio, quote, Earth Summit of 1992 would be the biggest UN talk fest to date, with its policy centerpiece, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, FCCC. But few would ever guess just how much this convention was a political triumph, not for UNEP, but for the conference host, Brazil. Its success would set in train the role of the poor countries in the climate treaty negotiations, where the talks stalled and stalled again, with their repeated attempts to use the pretext of warming mitigation to increase the flow of aid. In The Age of Global Warming, Rupert Darwall details how global environmentalism concentrated itself onto the global warming scare. Here, we take up with a group of activist climate scientists, tracing how they entered this political game, how the greater politics of the UN quickly overwhelmed and corrupted their science, and, finally, how the academies of science were soon dragged down with them. Science for Policy. Behind the establishment of the IPCC was a conscious effort by some scientists to get the science for policy mechanism right. Pitfalls at the policy interface were all too familiar to those involved. On the one hand, there were always scientists with extreme views capturing media attention and generating an inflated sense of alarm. When the Intergovernmental Assessment Panel was first formally proposed at the 10th World Meteorological Congress in May 1987, the Ice Age scare of the 1970s was well remembered. Asked to assess the science behind this scare, national scientific academies delivered sobering reports, and the WMO itself made some effort to quell alarm. But then there were those also concerned that well-founded alarm might go unheeded, especially when a global problem requires a cooperative response. The IPCC was to provide the balance. The basic design was for two distinct tiers: first, the scientific assessment, and then the science policy interface. In the first tier were elected experts from the relevant fields assessing the current state of the science. They drafted a report, circulated it for peer review, and then redrafted it in response to that review. The second tier involved science-literate government delegates agreeing on a plain language summary of the report. This, quote, policymaker's summary would be at the same time grounded in science, policy relevant, yet politically neutral, and agreed by all. The workload of the assessment was divided between three working groups. Working Group 1, to assess the scientific basis of warming concerns. Working Group 2, to assess impacts of this warming. And Working Group 3, to consider response strategies, whether mitigation or adaptation. When the expert authors of each group submitted their completed report, they would also provide a drafted summary. This would then be finalized by consensus at a meeting of the delegations. All this was to take place before the three parts of the report arrived at a full session of the IPCC. There, a further summary of these summaries would be negotiated to consensus, thereby producing a peak document for delivery into the policy debate. Indeed, as the process came to completions, just as a synthesis report was drafted by the renowned atmospheric scientist chairing the IPCC, Bert Bolin. At only the fourth full session of the IPCC, it was even partially approved before the Brazilian-led revolt left it in tatters on the floor of that conference hall in Sundsvall. But that is getting ahead of ourselves. Greenhouse postponed. The IPCC Working Group 1 had the easiest task as they trod a familiar path of U.S. government assessments back through the 1980s. But it was another international assessment conducted by another international science body that served as the principal model for their reports. The International Council of Scientific Unions, ICSU, is constituted of representatives from most of the world's national science academies and the various international scientific unions. It had long coordinated international geophysical research before establishing a Scientific Committee on Problems of the Environment, SCOPE, to report to the Stockholm Conference. Beyond Stockholm, the SCOPE Committee continued to commission environmental assessments, including one on the greenhouse effect, SCOPE 29, completed in 1985. Not only would this be the forerunner to the IPCC scientific assessment, it was also the basis for a conference in the Austrian village of Villach that is often hailed as the birthplace of the climate treaty movement. Convened in autumn 1985 by the ICSU, along with UNEP and WMO, this conference generated momentum for urgent global action. The UNEP executive director, Mustafa Tolba, made a particularly strong case to the 89 invited experts for the commencement of another treaty process, like he was then facilitating to protect the ozone layer. The final agreed statement concluded that greenhouse warming was, quote, expected, that it, quote, appeared inevitable, and that the prospect of catastrophic warming, with a doubling of greenhouse gas concentrations as early as 2030, required urgent mitigating action. Yet the SCOPE report itself was of quite a different tenor. Sure, the computer modeling predicts the usual range of warming for an equivalent doubling of CO2, 1.5 to 5.5 degrees Celsius, but this remains nothing more than theoretical speculation until it is validated empirically. The section where the progress of this validation is assessed offers the least cause for alarm. During the 1980s, there was much apprehension in government reviews and elsewhere about claims based on what the Villach statement called, quote, advanced experiments with general circulation models. But even the modeling advocates recognized that policy commitments would be unlikely without empirical evidence that, firstly, variations in atmospheric CO2 concentrations had a significant impact on global climate, and, secondly, that the contribution of industrial emissions was already having such an impact. The detection of even the slightest suggestion of an anthropogenic influence might have been sufficient grounds for policy action, but it would surely be the minimum grounds. All the government-run assessments agreed that the theoretical cause-effect relationship between emissions and warming had not been established, and this international assessment for ICSU presented no exception. The Empirical Climate Studies section of the SCOPE report was compiled at the Climatic Research Unit, University of Norwich, under Tom Wigley, a leader of, quote, detection research through the 1980s. Wigley found not only that the influence of emissions remained undetected, but also that evidence was insufficient for natural CO2 variations causing changes in the past. When, in 1989, Wigley was asked to coordinate the drafting of the, quote, detection chapter, Chapter 8, of the IPCC report, no new evidence persuaded him from these conclusions. The preceding chapter in the IPCC report also discussed persuasive evidence in the climate record, running contrary to the hypothesis that CO2 was a significant driver of change. So, with the IPCC Working Group 1 report finalized in 1990, we had a second international assessment in 5 years, coming to the same conclusions on the empirical science that we found in all the various government assessments during the preceding decade. In between, James Hansen of NASA made front-page news by calling for climate action after giving testimony to U.S. Congress of 99% certainty that man-made climate change is happening now. But with his performance followed by a wave of remonstration among his peers, the IPCC report only serves to confirm it as the grandstanding of an extremist. Nevertheless, Hansen's call to action only reiterated the plea from Vlock, and when Scope 29 was published in 1986, the Vlock statement had been placed at its front, as though an executive summary of the non-prescriptive, equivocating underlying report. With the IPCC, it was a different story. The summary at its front, as agreed by all the governments, was notable for its fidelity with the underlying report. Sure, some speculation was puffed up to appear more solid, but mostly it remained true to a report that hardly constitutes a scientific basis for urgent and drastic action. In other words, and to the credit of its designers, the science-to-policy process had worked. Consider also how, in the review process, Wigley was asked to consider when the human influence will start to become apparent. In 1981, he had suggested this likely around 2000, but by 1990, he was not so confident. Only when the half a degree of warming seen in the first half of the 20th century is again repeated, concluded Wigley, will we then be likely to determine just how much of it is human-induced. The IPCC also moderated the expected rate of greenhouse gas buildup, and so, according to the worst-case modeling, this extra warming was not expected for at least a decade, but more likely not for many decades. In other words, not only had detection been postponed, but, as Brian O'Brien was quick to declare, so too had the whole emergency. Alas, by that stage no one was listening. 3 years after the IPCC process was first conceived, the working group set to establish the scientific basis for action found itself the calm center of a maelstrom of climate enthusiasm brewing all around. As it would eventually break the science-to-policy process, let's go back and consider that brewing storm. Warming enthusiasm. The IPCC was conceived before the frenzy for action whipped up during the hot, dry North American summer of 1988, but it was then born into the storm of enthusiasm that ensued. In the first place, there was the grandstanding of extremists like Hansen. On top of that came minor state leaders like Gro Brundtland, Norway, and Brian Mulroney, Canada, channeling the enthusiasm for sustainable development, something of a campaign yet to find its cause. Then, topping it all, came Margaret Thatcher, propelling climate action up the agenda of the Group of Seven talks. And yet, after all the excitement of that summer, the first session of the IPCC in the autumn remained a relatively low-key affair. Only 30 delegations arrived, and these mostly from northern countries already active in the research. What really drove political interest came only weeks later with the first resolution committing the UN to protect the global climate. This resolution did more than endorse a new UNEP WMO panel. The IPCC was also asked to make recommendations on the use of relevant existing international legal instruments and to explore elements for inclusion in a possible future international convention on climate, Article 10. And so begins 1989. The year the Cold War ended was extraordinary for the intensification of interest in climate action at the intergovernmental level. While Wigley and all the other authors were busy taking their chapters through the review process, numerous ministerial conferences convened around the world to address the climate emergency. Their concluding statements competed for the louder alarm, while participants queued to pledge themselves for saving the planet. Already in January, a harbinger of the pending onslaught appeared before the IPCC. The U.S. Secretary of State for the new Bush administration, James Baker, chose for his first public engagement to open a session of their Working Group 3 with a call for political action. From the beginning, political interest was concentrated on this policy group, as Working Group 3 was often called, and the USA had already won its chair. With this new UN resolution pushing the IPCC further into the domain of policy development, the intensifying political interest concentrated overwhelming pressure on this group. However unwelcome, this premature political excitement might be for Bolin as he tried to deliver it for some scientific grounding. The effect was that Tolba's vision of a climate treaty process now realized sufficient political ground. And so Tolba formally submitted a plan for UNEP to work with WMO and the IPCC towards delivering a framework convention. The UNEP plan was approved by the General Assembly in December 1989, and from early 1990, the detail was widely known and generally agreed. In August, the IPCC would approve its interim report in Sundsvall before presenting it to the Second World Climate Conference in November and to the General Assembly in December. Then, early in 1991, its parent bodies would open negotiations to develop a framework convention so that an agreed text could be ready for signing at UNEP's anniversary Earth Summit in 1992. In Washington, February 1990, attendance at the third full session of the IPCC had swollen to 260 delegates from 62 countries. President Bush opened proceedings with an enthusiastic speech in which he demonstrated his commitment to the UNEP plan by repeating an offer to host the first session of convention negotiations. Throughout the year, WMO and UNEP busily prepared for these negotiations in various ways, even by convening an ad hoc planning group of government representatives. They met only once, just after Sundsvall, but for all appearances at least, the UNEP plan was on track right up to the World Climate Conference. There, Thatcher took the completed and approved IPCC report as, quote, our signpost, directing UNEP and WMO, which were the principal vehicles, taking us to our destination, a climate treaty. As we know, the Poor Countries Alliance made sure that these vehicles never hit that road. What was their beef? The aspirations of the poor. In the early days of the UN, its impoverished members were in fragmented minorities. But as decolonization progressed, a majority emerged and began to assert itself in the trade talks as the Group of 77. On the environmental front, even before Stockholm, it became clear that coordinated global action would only be possible if made attractive to governments of the decolonized world. This generally meant some commitment to a flow of resources from rich to poor, but with some sort of legitimation, looking better than a ransom payment. And that still left the problem of economic growth. The conflict between environmental goals and the development goals of the so-called developing world had to be resolved. And so it was in the Doctrine of Sustainable Development. The Sustainable Development philosophy, promoted famously in the Brundtland Report, 1987, would be epitomized in the Rio Goals and Agenda 21 of the Earth Summit. But by then, it was already well established in the climate talks, as is evidenced by the Framework Convention. This document defined the differential commitments of its signatories across the developed-developing divide and called for the one side to help the other towards their common future through transfer of money and technology. Technological transfer, as a condition of agreement, was not new even with the climate negotiation. Throughout the 1980s, the UN Law of the Sea talks had been locked down by such demands. If only under a new banner, the climate talks were similarly stalled with the bigger players, including Brazil, India, and China, pitched against the USA. Not only should legally binding emissions targets be limited to those who have caused the problem, but already before Sundsvall, in the policy discussion of Working Group 3, there were demands that the post-industrial rich sponsor a more sustainable industrial development across the impoverished regions of the world. The IPCC process had begun with a scientific leadership ready to address the sensitivities of development politics. Their first problem was to get delegations to show up. A trust was soon established to fund attendance, and a special committee convened to support the active participation of those struggling even to find science-literate delegates. It was only with this success that the trouble began. Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.